It's time for a more in-depth look at today's news. It's time to find out who's pulling the strings. It's time for the Behind the Curtain podcast with your host, author Jeff Reynolds.
Hello, and welcome into episode 12 of the Behind the Curtain podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Reynolds. This week, I feature two interviews with folks who thrust themselves into the arena to expose massive fraud and corruption in government. My first guest is Ralph Taylor. Ralph is the plaintiff in a federal court case that currently sits waiting approval of cert at the Supreme Court. His case blows the lid off massive corruption in the awarding of federal contracts to minority-owned businesses. He demonstrates how thousands of Caucasians may have been granted such contracts, how his DNA test that shows some African and Hispanic blood qualified him for minority status at the state level but not at the federal level, and how some Indian tribes are granting tribal membership without having to prove a certain percentage of Native American blood. Somewhere, Elizabeth Warren is drooling at the possibilities. Quick note, there's no bonus segment this week for Patreon, but you really should go check out previous recordings. There's tons of extra info available exclusively for our patrons, which you can find at patreon.com/behindthecurtain with Jeff Reynolds. My Oregon guest this week is Senator Dennis Linthicum from Klamath Falls. Dennis participated in the Senate Republican walkout over the past several days to deny quorum in the chamber in a desperate attempt to slow down some really bad bills being forced on Oregonians by the Democrats, who hold supermajorities in both chambers of our legislature. Dennis explains what the Republicans were protesting and trying to stop, what they got as part of the bargain to return and hold the votes on Monday, and why they had to end their walkout. We also discuss what the landscape looks like as we head into the election year of 2020. Don't forget to subscribe to the Behind the Curtain podcast wherever you listen to it, and please leave a positive rating. The more subscribers and the better ratings, the higher Behind the Curtain will rank on podcast services like iTunes and Google Podcasts, among many others. I'm happy to report that my book continues to generate buzz week after week. It's called Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. I continue to be in demand for radio interviews and speaking engagements. If you'd like to book me to speak to a group who might get something out of following the dark money on the left, please email me at info@5440fight.com. Search for the book in stores or online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Simon & Schuster. It's available in hardback, Kindle, or Nook now. Check out whoownsthedems.com for more information. Okay, welcome into the next segment of the Behind the Curtain podcast with Jeff Reynolds. My guest today is Ralph Taylor up in Washington State, and Ralph has a really unique court case going on right now, and it's actually been going on for quite some time, and it's been picked up by the Supreme Court. Ralph, welcome in.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well. Why don't you describe real quick for the listeners how your case got started and kind of the evolution it's taken?
Okay, just a clarification, hasn't been picked up yet, so that's what I'm hoping. It's at the Supreme Court. So
you're waiting for cert.
Yeah, I'm hoping it gets picked up.
So, gotcha.
And I'm doing everything I can to get it picked up, so I think it's important. But the genesis of the case was a very long time ago. I ran across a guy who was very visually Caucasian.
Ran across a guy that was what?
Visually Caucasian.
Oh, I see.
So, and he was talking about having gotten, benefits from being a minority, and it's, basically it's not what you know, it's who you know, which, piqued my interest because I'd already ran a DNA test on myself. And just to verify my ancestral heritage, it came back with I had anticipated, and I came back with 90% Caucasian, 4% Black, and 6% Native American, and that comes from my dad's side, who I also did a DNA test on, and he came back with higher levels, and he's from the Virginia Blue Ridge Mountains, so we're pretty well mixed with every possible early ethnicity that there was, which is the Black and Native American and Caucasian.
Sure.
So after getting my test done, I applied to the OMWBE to get a certification as a minority, And initially they denied me, and I basically, you know, told them that, hey, I know that Caucasians are getting certified as minorities because, you know, I've seen this.
And what is the OMWB?
OMWE is the Office of Minority Women Business Enterprise. They're the department that the Department of Transportation uses to administer their minority programs.
Gotcha.
So if you wanted to get certification as a minority program, then you would, you know, get a hold of these guys in the state of Washington, at least.
Okay.
So I got the, I applied for the application, and they initially turned me down, and then we litigated, and right before we went to court, and again, this is my opinion, they reversed their position. They initially said I wasn't black, and then they reversed their position and said I am black. And the definition of black is to have an ancestral background to the continent of Africa. So, and again, I think that they didn't want to go to court because then we'd be able to get them on the stand in front of a jury and, you know, basically ask them the questions of what does a person have to look like and, you know, that type of thing. So they certified me. So in the state of Washington, I'm certified as black, you know, black American. So then I went to the same department again, because they handle the federal certification as well as the state certification. So I went to them again with a new application, having been certified as black by that department. I put my application in. The exact same person who did my initial application came back again and said, well, you don't look black to us, so we're not going to give it to you. So she'd certified me as black already, and then she came back and said, well, you're not black.
So you're black according to the state of Washington, but according to the federal government, you're not.
I'm black, and because my birth certificate has been amended, and birth certificates are proof of ethnicity. I'm black in all 50 states, basically, because birth certificates are documentation of ethnicity. So I'm black in Washington and all 50 states, but I'm not black federally. So I'm driving down, you guys are down in the Portland, I'm driving down I-5, and I'm Caucasian on I-5 since the federal highway, and then I get off to Vancouver in Washington, get off the 5 and get onto a state road or, you know, city road, I become black. So, I mean, it doesn't seem to make any sense, does it?
Well, so this kind of points out the hypocrisy of the programs and the corruption of these state contracting programs that are trying to support and grant favoritism to minority-owned businesses. It just doesn't. There's no real definition of what a minority-owned business is.
There's no definition of a minority. I mean, the definition, I mean, I could say that you look Asian to me, you know, whatever ethnicity you are. I could just say a different ethnicity and say, well, prove that you're not that ethnicity. And there's nothing in the federal definitions about looks. It just says having an ancestral background to Africa. So,
well, doesn't the entire human race have an ancestral background back to Africa?
Well, that's what I'm thinking. the looks don't matter because I've audited the entire country as far as these departments to see how prevalent it was that Caucasians were being certified. And we, you know, based on the audits we did and the numbers we could look at, you know, just by getting on their social pages, you know, we estimated there's tens of thousands of Caucasians that have been certified as minorities. And, you know, you go into any Native American tribe and you can see all the Caucasians who are Native American. And, you know, the Native Americans are, you know, some tribes will let you in just for whatever reason. I was directed to a tribe by the BIA to join a tribe because they admit non-Native Americans into their tribe. So it's, you know, this tribal
So membership. If you're referred to one of these tribes, you can actually be certified as having Native American blood without a DNA test.
You can be certified as a Native American. you don't have to have any Native American heritage whatsoever. You know, it's up to the tribe's own discretion, because they're a sovereign nation, about who they want to let in, who they don't want to let in. So it's become, you know, in my opinion, it's almost become a political payback tool. If we'll let you in if you do this for us, and then you'll get the benefits of being a tribal member, which is, you know, there are a large amount of benefits to that. And this certification was offered to me if I would have gotten my birth certificate amended right at the beginning of the process, but I didn't feel that I should have to jump through the hoops of getting my birth certificate amended if they know that birth certificates are amendable. So, I mean, you could get your birth certificate amended just by calling whatever state you were born in, and if there's an ethnicity portion on it, you just say, I want this changed to reflect this. So I called in and got mine amended, and it used to show Caucasian for my father. Now it shows Black, Native American, and Caucasian. And my grandfather's birth certificate has a question mark on ethnicity.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's, you know, it doesn't take many generations to get visual cues of whatever ethnicity you think you may be out of your biological visual line. You know,
right.
You could have, you know, 4 or 5 generations back, you could have someone, whether or not it's Asian or Native American or Black or whatever, and if you produce within the Caucasian race, those visual traits would all, you know, they would be gone. You still have the ancestral background, but the visual traits themselves would be gone. But again, they offered it to me, and I just chose to, because the person had gotten so much money, and I was disgusted by the sheer fact, the only reason I'm being offered this is because I found out about it. And if this is the way the game is played, then everybody deserves to know that this is the way the game is played. But, you know, my end game is to try to get the Supreme Court to look at these definitions and rule them unconstitutional, and then we can retool this system and make it be socioeconomic.
Oh, so you want to see the racial preferences go away entirely and make it based on socioeconomic factors instead?
Well, that would be, I mean, right now we use this to try to make amends for whatever social injustices people think their forefathers were subjected to, but mine were subjected to them just as much as anybody else's. There's nobody in today's world that, has been a slave in our country anyways. The Irish were slaves when they were first brought over. And
so were the Chinese.
Yeah, and so were the Chinese. So everybody wants to get reparations. It's like, well, as far as blacks, only 1 to 2% of Caucasians owned blacks in the South, and blacks owned blacks as well as far as slaves. So that's like, why are 98% of the country going to have to, if this mindset continues, have to pay for 1%? And they, nobody today has been persecuted with that. So I mean, the only way to do this is where it doesn't divide us as a country, in my opinion, is to make it on a socioeconomic basis. If you want to drive money into specific geographical footprints, you can, by using tax returns and looking at the median income and median housing prices. And that's a way to make people, help people, without it having race be the dividing factor, especially since they know that, the government knows that they cannot define race. It's an outdated tool, and the more people find out that, it doesn't matter that, Indians, Native American tribes are adopting non-Native Americans in, and then, you can be Hispanic and be Caucasian, you can be Native American and be Caucasian, then it's just a matter of who's in and who's out, and then it becomes a matter of political payback and, all types of things that can go on. So my ultimate goal is to get seen in front of the Supreme Court and then have those definitions be, basically, they can't enforce those definitions, because there's no way they're going to be objective enough.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go back to the beginning real quick. What's the basis of your lawsuit? What kind of a contract were you applying for?
Well, I had the option of looking at the Seattle Tunnel Project. So they had a 22% DBE goal. I think it was 22% goal of they wanted 22% of the gross, you know, receipts to go to minority-owned firms, and they hit like 2-3%. If I, you know, I haven't looked at it in a long time, but that's what their numbers were from what I recall.
And so, when did this start?
This was 8-10 years ago. So I've been working on this for, you know, initially about 12 years ago.
Okay.
So it's been I've had to sue the federal government to make them make a decision on my case because they were held to make a decision, and they, about a week before their timeline ran out, they called and said, "We're really busy, we'll get to this when we get to it," which was basically them telling me, in my opinion, that they're never going to get to this.
Right. They wanted to slow walk it past the deadline.
Well, they wanted to slow walk it into it. You know, into a perpetuity where it never gets addressed. So I had to litigate against the government to force them to do their job. And then, after I litigated, then they came back and said, "Well, you're not black." And it's like, "Well, you know, tell me why I'm not black." And we submitted files of Caucasians that have been certified as minorities, and the court threw those files out as evidence. It's like, "Well, how can I prove that I've been discriminated against if you don't allow the files of the Caucasians who have been certified as minorities as evidence?"
You're saying this is on a pretty massive scale, right? Lots of white folks who are applying under minority status, right?
There's, you know, we just looking at the SBA and this DOT programs, you know, we estimated there's tens of thousands of Caucasians that are in there, and that's just those two departments. It doesn't take into consideration the Department of Education or any of the other federal departments that are getting funded by the federal government that have these percentages that they need to fulfill. I mean, if the people inside the government know that they don't have any objective definitions, and they're the only ones who know, then they're the only ones who are going to benefit, them and their friends and family and that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, and that just goes back to basic biology, right? That really among humans, there's very little other than physical features to define what race is.
Well, you can't even define it with physical features. I mean, there's no two people look the same. We've decided that based on some subjective ideas, we're classifying people as a specific race, and it's like, "Well, why don't we use, you know, height, or why don't we use, you know, the size of your thumbs or whatever?" I mean, but, you know, we've pigeonholed ourselves into using a color, and that color spectrum, there is no line. So you can't say this guy looks black when Caucasians can be black. You can't say this guy looks Native American because there's tons, you know, there's thousands of Native Americans who are Caucasian.
Yeah. I mean, so you're not denying the history of racial discrimination, though, right?
No, I mean, no, it is something that we as a country have, you know, in our past. It doesn't make it, you know, right or wrong or good or bad. Obviously, it was a tragedy that of part of our country, but there's no way that we continue, there's no way we get past this if we continue to divide ourselves by race, and that the government knows that these definitions are arbitrary. You know, it's just a matter of getting it out into the marketplace that, you know, A, it's, I'm going to either get the law, or B, I'm going to let all the attorneys, you know, a large amount of attorneys across the country, you know, this is how you want to play if you're going to play this game. And here's how to get through, and here's, you know, what you need to do. And either it's going to, you know, the Supreme Court can address it, or they can address it when it gets so diluted that it doesn't matter. I mean, the more people that know that Caucasians are getting through, the more there's going to be business guys who say, you know what, I've got this in my past just like anybody else does, so I want the benefit. And everybody says, well, you know, have you been, you know, suffered from racism? It's like, well, racism is a third-party issue, so it's how am I supposed to tell somebody that I have if it's my own subjective belief? You know, it's easy to say, well, I was, you know, discriminated against, but most people aren't going to tell you that they're discriminating against you because they don't want to have the litigation brought down on them.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Anybody that is not hiring somebody because of the color of their skin would be stupid to say so.
Yeah, it'd be more than stupid.
Right. So it goes to a little bit deeper issue, though, is how do you prove discrimination? How do you prove racism? And obviously, there are lots of people that are gaming the system because the system's basically set up to be exploited and corrupted.
Well, I sent an email to the Attorney General's office, one of the attorneys working for the Attorney General's office for Washington, asking him, as a public records request, when did you know that Caucasians were being certified? And they wouldn't answer the question. They go, we're not going to answer that question. So it's like, well, you just answered it by answering. It's like you know that it's going on, but you know they're just hoping that my case just dies and that the bigger issue doesn't get addressed. And again, in my opinion, the courts are doing everything they possibly can to help them.
Yeah, you know, it would really be difficult for these people to proceed if all of a sudden we know that the Supreme Court has ruled that there's all these Caucasians that are taking advantage of this program that was intended to help minorities, but then we also can't go back and come up with a sufficient, legally sound definition of what race is and what a minority is.
Well, they can't, and they know they can't. But I had the Florida A&M Law School file an amicus brief at the Ninth Circuit. They agreed with me that the definition is arbitrary and capricious, but they also put forth saying, okay, well, we agree that this definition is arbitrary, but here's how we suggest fixing it. And one of theirs was you have to be 1/8 black or 1/8 this or 1/8 that.
Mm-hmm. And, a lot of Native American tribes have a similar sort of barrier or bar to get over.
No, I mean, the person we found through a public records request on the state of Washington, he's a Native American, and he's 1/256. So again, tribes can do whatever they want. And that's, you know, that is, I mean, they're basically the new group of people that are getting preferential treatment, and their ability to let anybody in to the tribe if they choose to let them in is, it's a bad, you know, a bad way to run the system in the future for the rest of us, because, you know, if you're not politically connected or you're not doing whatever, if they're not letting you in, you're at a disadvantage. I mean, I could have called that tribe that they asked me to call, but again, I just, to myself, I had to make a decision a long time ago. Do I take the money, or do I say, I'm 56 years old, I'll be dead in 10, 20 years. Do I try to fix a system that I know and they know is broken? It's just, you know, they're doing everything they can to try to shut me down, in my opinion. It's, you know, how can that there not be an issue of law to let me proceed? Because at this point in time, we're just suing to go to court. Is how can there not be an issue of law for this to be addressed when I'm black at the state level, black in all the other states and not the federal level, and we've given you the files of Caucasians that are certified as minorities? You know, it's, there's days when I step back and say, I wish I would have just taken the money. It would have been a lot it would have been a lot easier than it is.
Right. But this is fundamentally wrong and broken.
It's fundamentally wrong. I mean, there was a little girl in Alabama who, a little black girl, who was getting teased by her fellow, you know, students because she had Caucasian friends, and she got so distraught over it, she hung herself. And that, to me, is just a tragedy because the government knows that they can't come up with these definitions, come up with an objective definition, but they gain so much power by this division that they want to keep it that way. You know, they don't care if they're inside of it. You know, they are able to keep us at each other's throats over something that doesn't really have any objective criteria to it, then, you know, they gain.
Okay, so Ralph, give us the current status of your case. It's being considered by the Supreme Court, correct?
Yeah, we sent it in. It became official last Monday. So it goes to the group, and if four of the Supreme Court justices want to see it, then it gets picked up. So I'm hoping, you know, I'm going to send out an informational packet to all the law schools in the country and then 20,000 lawyers and say, hey, try to write an amicus brief for me or let them know why you think the system should stay the same way it is. So it's basically, if I can get enough amicus briefs or get enough media attention, then I might be able to get it picked up. I've hit, you know, the two of the factors they look at it as, has it been in the press? And, you know, the four specific outlets is the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, and the LA Times. And I've been in two of those, so I'll be sending packets to the other two. And so if it gets picked up, then it'll probably get seen next year. But if it gets picked up, then it can fundamentally, hopefully, do some good for our country to make people understand is that, you know, Caucasians are being let in, and I don't have any negative feelings towards the Caucasians that are inside the system because they've played within the rules of the game. It's just the rules of the game are hurting our country as a whole. So yeah. It's better to, you know, it'll probably be a shock to everybody's system, but it's like the government doesn't have it. They just don't have it. And the best way to help people is to help them based on socioeconomic, because it takes away that negative energy of racial, you know, obviously it's going to take time, but it's going to take it away, in my opinion, at least, or that, or I've wasted a ton of money and ton of time.
Well, let's hope that we stop someday soon dividing Americans by race and uniting under the fact that we're all Americans. Everybody can agree with that.
Well, that's my objective. I mean, that was my objective from day one. Again, I got this offered to me multiple times through multiple means, getting the certification. I just chose never to take it. And it would have been a lot of money, but like I said, I'm an older man, and, you know, if my daughters have to live in this system, my children's children will have to live in this system, and if you can't go through a day of turning on the news without something popping up about racial hatred and racial this and racial that, and if they lose their definitions, if, you know, the Al Sharptons or the Louis Farrakhan's or the Richard
Spencer.
Yeah, Spencer of the white, you know, white supremacy crud. You know, if they lose their ability to define themselves, then they're going to lose their ability to, you know, drive as much hate as they do.
That's a really good point. And it would be wonderful if someday we could get back to content of character, not color, in.
Well, the you know, these racial definitions, if you look back in history, they were not an issue, you know, 1,000 years ago. People were based, you know, it's in the 1400s, 1500s, Spain is the country that started to develop these racial definitions so that they could create classes.
Hmm.
And, you know, but before that, you go through history, you know, you're not going to see, you know, like Genghis Khan, he didn't care what color you were. If you were an effective, you know, general for him, he promoted you. It was a meritocracy. It wasn't you look like me, so I'm going to promote you. He promoted based on ability to succeed.
Well, and that's what our free society is supposed to be set up to be, right, is a meritocracy. Not necessarily the same as Genghis Khan, but...
Yeah. Well, it's just that's way that we can get rid of a lot of anger and hostility if we can move past this. And, you know, eventually it's going to break. I mean, if there's tens of thousands of Caucasians that are already in and the America starts to understand that it's just a game that's being played, then they will, you know, I think that that process will start to heal the country.
All right.
I have every, you know, I am visually Caucasian, you know, and I'm, you know, a little darker because of my color, but I have every right to say my forefathers were slaves as much as anybody who looks black. And my forefathers were just as many generations removed from slavery than somebody who thinks they're deserving of reparations.
Right.
And, you know, that I talked to somebody and it's like, well, how do you come up with, you know, decide who gets reparations? And they go, well, if you can trace your lineage back to a slave. And I traced my lineage back to, you know, a black woman in Virginia, but when the Civil War went through, Grant and Sherman came through the South, they burned all the record depositories. So it's hard to find anything prior to the Civil War as far as records because, you know, the government burned them all.
Yeah, and that's a really important point because how can you justify or how can you prove that people aren't getting reparations that supposedly deserve them, or you know, it's a huge can of worms opening this up, and we will never be able to solve the problem, and it'll just divide this further.
Yeah, it's, you know, to me it's just everybody, you know, says, yeah, let's give reparations or we need a study for reparations. It's like only, you know, 1% of the Caucasians owned 1-2% of the Caucasians owned slaves, and you know, blacks owned slaves, and like you said, the Chinese were slaves, the Irish were slaves. So who gets it, who doesn't, and who has to pay?
Yeah.
You know, does everybody have to pay the 99% of the Caucasians that have no, you know, history of owning slaves have to pay? And then what about the, you know, the 300,000 plus people who died from the North trying to end slavery? So those guys have to pay, and not only did they give their lives, but their progeny now has to pay, you know, for slavery on top of it, their forefathers giving their lives to end slavery.
You know, it's certainly a thorny issue.
To me, it's a thorny issue, knowing that how many Caucasians have been certified as minorities. It is definitely a thorny issue, and knowing the fact that I was directed to a tribe to get enrolled as a Native American is to me a thorny issue.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, that's pretty amazing. Okay, Ralph Taylor, thank you so much for joining me on the Behind the Curtain podcast. Anything else you want to say about your case before we sign off here?
Anybody that's listening, they should call their local department, ask for a copy of the files, and they'll be able to see how many Caucasians have been certified
under minority contracting.
Ask for the. I had someone who heard me on Lars Larson called the state of Washington and asked for the files, the pictures of the files, and they wouldn't give them to him.
Really? Even though that's public record?
Even though it's public record, they said they use some legalese to say, no, that's proprietary information that we don't have to give you. And it's like, it's the picture. So it's like, why are you not giving the information to verify that you're not certifying Caucasian? So I would tell your listeners to just call their state. I don't know where, you know, your podcast gets picked up, but call their state and ask them, you want to see the pictures of these departments to show.
Yeah.
And it's not just Washington, and it's not just these two departments. Like I said, if this is the way the game's going to be played, then everybody needs to know how this game is being played so they can participate too. And by doing that, it pretty much saturates it to the point of nothingness anyways. If you have a business guy and you tell him, we can increase your you're gross by you saying that you're this minority or that, he's probably going to do it. When I had, you know, when I had my birth certificate amended, I called California and I said, I want my birth certificate to reflect my ethnicity. The person who took the call at the center asked if I wanted to change my sex at the same time. So I could have gone from being a Caucasian male to being a black female with a signature.
Oh my goodness.
That's on a legal, and it would have been all legal.
Yeah, sure.
So it's, you know, if I can be a black female, then, you know, I would suggest everybody out there just get their birth certificates amended if you want to. You know, if you're applying to some to Harvard and you don't think you can get it if you're a Caucasian, just get your birth certificate amended to whatever you want. Now you're that.
If we can't change this broken system, then let's just overwhelm it.
Well, that's, you know, that's what I'm hoping. Either A, the Supreme Court picks it up, or if I get enough press out there, the general public finds out about it, then they'll just saturate it and destroy it that way.
Yep.
But one way or the other, we can make it be socioeconomic so we don't hate each other as much.
Well, it's a worthy goal, and I very much wish you luck with your case at the Supreme Court. I hope they pick it up, and I hope that it has a positive outcome.
I do, too, for you, for me, and for the rest of the country.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks again, Ralph Taylor, for joining me on the Behind the Curtain podcast with Jeff Reynolds.
All right. Thank you, Jeff.
If you like this podcast, the best way you can support it is by leaving a rating and subscribing. And don't forget to buy my book, Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. Now it's on to the Oregon story of the week with Senator Dennis Linthicum from Klamath Falls. All right, welcome back to this week's segment of the Oregon segment of the Behind the Curtain podcast with Jeff Reynolds. I'm here with a special guest, Senator Dennis Linthicum of Klamath Falls, Oregon. Senator Linthicum was part of the Senate GOP caucus walkout that was organized last week and this week. They denied quorum to the supermajority of Democrats in Salem in the Senate to protest some bad bills that were coming down the pike and to try to slow down the freight train of bad stuff coming from the supermajority of Democrats. Senator Linthicum, welcome on in.
Thank you. It's good to be able to join you today. I appreciate you taking the time to air this. And I like the name of your podcast, Behind the Scenes or Behind the Curtains, because nothing gets seen. You know, it's the Wizard of Oz scenario where nobody really knows who is that man behind the curtain.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why I started the podcast and wrote the book, Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy, because there are so many things that go on in plain sight that the media doesn't report on, that we never hear about. And, you know, the sort of, a lot of folks don't pay attention to the legislators anyway because the making of the sausage is kind of boring. But then you've got these, you know, these spectacular issues, these fireworks that go off, and that caused the Senate GOP caucus to stage their walkout last week. So tell me a little bit about that. How bad is it in Salem right now?
It's actually worse than you can imagine. You just referred to undermining democracy, and the United States is a constitutionally federated republic, and we have grown accustomed to calling it democracy, but our founders, John Adams, specifically said democracy will never last. He said it soon wastes and exhausts and murders itself. There has never yet been a democracy that did not commit suicide. And that's what we have. Democracy is mob rule. Democracy doesn't care about the minority. And that's exactly what we're seeing here at the in both chambers, in the House chamber and in the Senate chamber. This is mob rule. These people have the hands of power in their fists. They've got the supermajority in both chambers. They are giddy with power. They are drunk with power, and they're going to leverage their power to undo the state of Oregon. And there's little we can do to stop it, mainly because for all their clamoring to care about the minority and to care about those disenfranchised people, they actually don't. And, you know, although there are those occasional insights where people really do care, what we're seeing from the legislative body is a reluctance to give any consideration to any other part of the legislative process other than their own agenda. And so this indeed is very, very troubling, and it ought to be troubling for all of the Oregonians who are expecting representative government, not majority rule, minority gets disconsidered, disenfranchised.
You know, that's a really interesting point, too, because I've been concerned about supermajorities in both houses since even before Election Day. I kind of read the tea leaves during the election season and thought, oh, my gosh, we're going to get slaughtered. And what are the consequences? And it's, you know, these are the consequences, right? Elections have consequences. And yeah, so you make a very good point. And by the way, I should mention the title of my book was already long enough, so I didn't want to add constitutional republic, so I just used the convenient term of democracy. But I completely right, understand right. The difference between a constitutional republic and a democracy. So, but you bring up an excellent point that it's mob rule, and there's absolutely no respect for the rights of the minority. But really, if you look at the demographics of the state, we're not that far to the left, even though we have elected supermajorities of Democrats in both houses and Kate Brown as governor. We actually are much more balanced than what is represented in Salem currently. So don't you think, just from a electoral strategic standpoint, the Democrats should be a little bit more cautious?
Oh, absolutely. I think they're running headlong like the runaway freight train, and they have no idea the trestle bridge is out up ahead. And and you know, time after time, yesterday one of the bills we walked out for four specific reasons. One was the four mandatory vaccine coerced vaccination of your children without your consent, or either surrender to the needle or your child doesn't get educated in the state of Oregon. This is really a weird concept when you think about the rights of conscience of a free and independent culture. And then the other one was the Senate Bill 978, which was just a crazy menagerie of regulation against law-abiding citizens who happen to own firearms. And the next one was PERS. There is no fix for PERS. And the last item that finally triggered our walkout was House Bill 3427, which pretends to fund education. But the legislative council tells us specifically in an opinion letter, they wrote a letter that says, by the way, 3 points, it cannot be dedicated to education. One, because you cannot bind future legislative bodies. Two, because the only way to rightfully do that is at a constitutional amendment. And three, there is no way to stop a majority, quote unquote, that mob rule again, from taking the money and doing with it as they please. So we said, okay, we're out of here. These guys cannot be allowed to continue with that agenda. And their agenda, even today, now we're back and we're trying to, you know, go back to work, quote, if you will, for the good of the citizens of Oregon. And this label of good, you know, for the health and prosperity and safety of Oregonians, you know, quite frankly, I'm beginning to question the reality of that language, because it's really all about poking Trump in the political behind, or, you know, it's the Trump derangement syndrome right here in Oregon.
Very much
today,
so.
We passed a bill today, House Bill 2250, that has this line in it this bill specifies the baseline federal standards for Oregon is all the requirements that were in effect as of January 19th, 2017. Now, your listeners may be smart enough to know that January 19th, 2017 is the last day of the Obama administration, and the first day of the Trump administration was January 20th of 2017. So these guys today passed this bill that says we're going to follow all of the rules and all of the, you know, the federal registry, you know, thousands and thousands of propagated regulations and rules and requirements and fees and, you know, absurdities at the federal level up to and including January 1927, the last day of the Obama administration, but we're not going to do anything with the rules and requirements that come after that at the federal level. And this is insane.
That's illegal on so many levels, I'm not even sure I can count.
Well, yeah. And it's so at some point you see this is just the ambitious, you know, licentiousness that comes from the supermajority. They have just leaped into this mindset that says they can make up rules as they go along and they can do anything they want and they can pass these any which way they want. And today that just went through. And yet you have to realize, your listeners have to realize, we can't walk and stay out forever.
Right.
And the majority can call the state troopers to bring us back in handcuffs. They can actually, they have the authority to arrest us.
Yeah, which Kate is Brown really has that authority as governor.
Sergeant at Arms. We got a ruling from the Attorney General that's been passed around, and they can fine us up to $1,000 a day. So if there's, you know, 6 weeks at 5 days a week, that's, you know, do the math real fast. It's like, oh my gosh, that's 30 days times $1,000. That's $30,000 for each of the 12 Republican senators. Which of them can take that hit in the shorts plus pay for their lodging out of state or whatever? I mean,
yeah, that's a really important point to make, because I've had several conversations with Republican activists here in Oregon who have said that the Senate caved, that GOP senators caved in their negotiations and they should have stayed out longer. But nobody can afford that personal expense. That's really important. But I want you to talk about that aspect, but also the deal you struck, because I was actually impressed with the win you guys came up with, preserving our Second Amendment rights and preserving medical freedom, particularly the Second Amendment rights. That's a shot across their bow that you can't steal guns from Oregonians. That's one thing. That's one line you don't cross. And I think, quite frankly, you know, we have to fix PERS, and it's a big deal, but we don't have the political will to do so. So that was too big a lift. But for me personally, I've evolved on this issue to the point where I think guns are more important than taxes, from a personal freedom standpoint, from a defense of liberty, from a defense of the Constitution standpoint. So talk about the deal you guys made and why you couldn't go further and all of that.
Well, I think you laid it out very nicely. The ideals that we strove for were those your constitutional right of conscience. The Fourth Amendment says that the right of the people to be secure in their persons. Ta-da, stop right there. We don't have to go through all the other things. That freedom for your own person, your own conscience, your own consensual decisions with regard to you and your family, this is constitutional stuff. So we drove at protecting that, and we also drove at protecting, and I actually believe these are inalienable rights, aside from being having a second hallmark within the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. These are inalienable rights. We're all familiar with the inalienable clause, where for all men have been created and have been endowed by their creator, or all men have been created equal and they've been endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. and that among these are life and liberty and your own pursuit of happiness, your own just pursuits. So these are very fundamental, basic, inalienable rights, and the right to your life includes the right to protect your life and the life of your loved ones, and even protect the life of a stranger on the street. And so these are constitutional and fundamental inalienable rights, and we were willing to go to bat for those. Now, the idea about taxation, you know, as far as I'm concerned, 1913 was a horrible year. That's the year the 16th Amendment came into being, as well as the Federal Reserve and the 17th Amendment, where states are now have popular vote for their state senators that arrive into Washington, D.C. Had we kept those chained to the state legislature, we'd have a different world today. But state legislatures today gave up that call, and now we have the democracy rule, the mad mob ruling who becomes our state senators. And there's very little difference between the state senator and the various Senate districts that are around, other than popular vote. So it becomes very messy. But anyway, the 16th Amendment was the one with regard to taxation. And we've been marching down this socialist collectivist view about taxes are okay, just a little bit. And then the phrase just a little bit is getting, you know, twisted over and over and over again until right now everyone's crying uncle and saying, wait, that hurts. But we decided we couldn't argue that the taxes were too high or too right from a constitutional perspective. We're now in relativism, and it's relatively okay, it's relatively not okay, it's sort of bad, it's not terrible, etc. And you have a real difficult time weighing what that looks like in the public mind. So we didn't strive for zero taxes or zero funding of schools. We made the argument, fix PERS first, because if you don't stop the leakage coming out the backside of PERS, all the money in the world will never fix the actuarially accrued unfunded liability problem that we have, you know, killing our school districts and our municipal and county governments. They're just getting slaughtered by the PERS fiasco, and it's about time we fix that. The Senate Democrats actually aren't willing to fix it. Neither are the House Democrats. They're scared to death because their base loves the great bounty that they're reaping off the poor enslaved taxpayer.
So I want to go back real quick to the medical freedom issue and the vaccine issue, because I've struggled with this one personally. I'm pro-vaccine. I think that the idea that vaccines cause autism is ridiculous, given the fact that the guy that created the hoax admitted to it on his deathbed and said that he falsified all the information. And so there's no linkage between vaccines and autism. So a lot of folks look pretty silly with that, but it's a little bit more than that. I recently saw a photo of the vaccines that were required in 1983, then the ones that were required in 1993, and then the ones that are required today. And there are dozens and dozens of vaccines required, including HPV, which is a very controversial vaccine that a lot of folks don't think should be administered to children who shouldn't be having underage sex in the first place to have HPV propagated. So talk a little bit about this medical freedom bill and you know, because a lot of Republicans, especially up in my neck of the woods, are laughing a little bit and saying, well, you guys join the anti-vax crowd and you're anti-science and you make us look bad and all that stuff. So what is the issue at hand with the vaccines that has caused such an uproar and a lot of Democrats to switch over to our side?
Well, yeah, I think that's the best part of it. The compulsory vaccination, look at this, the state should not be coming. Let's pretend, for example, that you're okay with vaccines and I'm not. then you have the freedom to go vaccinate your children. The vaccines are widely available. They're available at any pharmacy on any corner. Your consent to go and approve of that medical treatment is perfectly legit. And the question is, why is it that you don't think I'm able to make that same decision for my family? And there's where the crux of the matter is. The crux turns on this idea of herd immunity. And there's a leap in logic with regard to herd immunity. It's based on three fundamental assumptions. First is that herd immunity is a valid, obtainable objective of vaccination policy. And yet none of these vaccines do anything for the herd. They only inoculate the individual. They do not inoculate the herd. Each individual who receives the vaccine is in fact inoculated. Point two is that somehow, without the magic of government forcing you to get this vaccine, you would never do it. And you, if you believe in free markets like I believe in free markets, then free market solutions are always the best solutions. And then the point in with regard to unvaccinated individuals in a mandated environment is there's potentially the free riders that are costing us as we have to inoculate their kids and they're not paying the fair share, et cetera. And the last part of it is that there is somehow this implied duty for society as the collective mindset overruns our individual mind as we all become collectivists instead of individualists, that somehow we have a duty to become inoculated just like all of our friends and neighbors. And I don't think any of those hold water. I don't think that's true. I'm not even talking about the safety of the vaccine, and safety of vaccines is actually quite questionable. How old are you? Can I ask on the air?
I'm 47.
Okay, you're 47. So I've got a good 15 years on you. And when my kids were little, when I was little, I never knew anybody that had a peanut butter allergy. I know they existed in the world. It's okay. Today, there are more children who are allergic to tree nuts and peanuts and walnuts and pistachio nuts and all of these chronic diseases, whether it's asthma, whether it's male infertility, whether it's autism or pandas or PANS, all of these things are chronic diseases to the point where now one in 36 children in the United States of America born today has a chance of being in the autistic spectrum disorder, in Asperger's spectrum. Now, this is really weird that one in 36 people in this current generation compared to one in several thousand, 10,000 in my generation. Nobody's asking the why question. So let's say it's Roundup and cell towers. Well, then why couldn't it be Roundup and vaccines and cell towers or something else? And that's my complaint about this entire rigmarole at state mandates, is we're using vaccination rates, which is the same as pharma sales to minor children, as a quote status symbol for whether we have a healthy community. I don't think vaccine sales to minor children should be used as an effective tool for measuring the health of our community. That's my complaint with the whole agenda.
You know, and that actually makes me think. I've thought for years that the entire idea, the entire industry of public health is kind of a scam. You know, it's the idea that somehow we have this collective health that we're all responsible for. Really, we're just we're only concerned. We should only be concerned with our own individual health and making ourselves the healthiest that we can be, so that we can be contributing members of society, which then strengthens our society. That the idea of public health just doesn't make sense to me, you know?
Well, and I actually think you're right, but remember, statism is our problem. I had an article I wrote a couple of weeks ago. What my opening sentence to catch everybody's, you know, to try and catch clicks on my article was, the title of it was called Poison Fruit. You can look at it by going to OregonLegislature.gov/Linthicum. But anyway, my opening sentence was, poison fruit can be grown in the poison fruit of statism can be grown in the orchard on the left-hand side of the road as well as the orchard on the right-hand side of the road. And my point about statism is, this is where the state grows and government grows, and we take all of the productivity from the individuals in our culture and society. We take all of the taxes and the money necessary to grow the state from the individuals and from their families. And this is what's so destructive. And I don't care if the poison fruit's growing on the left side and the Democrats are doing it, or it's growing on the right side and Republicans are doing it. What I care about is giving individuals their lives back, giving them their liberty back, giving them the freedom. And then I've got to always warn individuals, as soon as I give you your freedom, you're also going to carry with it this ball and chain known as personal responsibility. You can never talk about individual liberty without also carrying the weight of personal responsibility. And that's the kind of culture that we should be striving for here at the state level. And the supermajority has done away with personal responsibility. They want you to be responsible for your neighbor. They want you to carry his bag of groceries and pay for them at the checkout stand before you put them into his car that you paid for and sustained with your own tax dollars. This is the tragedy of the supermajority and the poison fruit of the left.
Okay, that's very well said, Senator Linthicum. You've given us a lot to think about here, so I really appreciate you coming on the Behind the Curtain podcast today. Real quick, last question, and then we'll wrap it up. But where do we go from here? Now that you've come back, you've struck a deal to protect personal liberties. You had to give up your opposition to lack of PERS reform and taxes and all that stuff. So where do we go from here? It doesn't sound like another walkout is likely unless something really bad comes down the pike. So where do we go from here for this session, the next session, and then Election Day 2020?
Well, yeah, Election Day 2020 will be a glorious event if I can wish for my way of thinking. You know, we need to strike at the root. We need to strike at the root and branch of the corruption that is, you know, pulsing through the veins of this building. Think about this for a second. This will be an interesting word picture for your constituents to think about as we close this radio show. What we hear at the state level, the reason we need DCBS to watch corporations, and the reason we need DHS to check out our population, and we need the Department of Ed to make sure your kids get educated, is because we think you as parents aren't good enough to educate your own children or smart enough to educate your own children, and nobody can trust those evil corporations, and we need state government to do these things for us. So your audience needs to ask, well, wait, if the natural tendency of mankind is this bad, and this is kind of a biblical principle, so we understand it, if the natural state of mankind is this ill-fitted for ruling their own families and their own businesses and their own enterprises, what makes us believe that they're well-fitted and well-suited to running the local government and breathing down your throat as they ask you for your wallet? I don't think they're well-suited for that. And what we have to do in Oregon as Republicans is we have to strike for individual liberty. We have to strike for freedom. And we have to continue to support the individual and their families well before we support the collectivism and the state-run machinery that is going to destroy businesses, jobs, and families here in Oregon.
All right, Senator Dennis Lindcombe, thank you so much for joining me on the Behind the Curtain podcast. Keep fighting for individual liberty and against statism. I mean, you've got me fired up and ready to fight. So thanks again. Real quick, mention for the listeners where they can find you on social media.
Sure. I don't actually tweet a lot. It's at Dennis Lindcombe is my Twitter handle. My Facebook handle will be, good grief, wouldn't I know? Just search for Dennis Lindcombe, state senator. And then you can find all of my articles. I've wrote probably 30 or 50 articles as the dirtroadeconomist.com. Those are all old. All my more recent articles are at OregonLegislature.gov/Lindthicum, LINTHICUM.
Perfect. Senator Lindthicum, thanks again for coming on.
You bet. Thank you. It's so good to talk to you. I hope we can make a difference and really turn the state around in the next election cycle.
Yep, 2020 is key for sure. Thanks again.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for checking out the Behind the Curtain podcast. I want to thank my buddy Brian Futch for providing me the theme song, I Am America, produced by Cass Anawati. Join us next Wednesday for another episode of Behind the Curtain with Jeff Reynolds.
Across the ocean, with nothing else but his dream for a better life. His folks over there shook their heads at such a crazy notion, but deep down in his heart he knew he was right. Cleared the way for you and me. You can still hear his spirit sing. I am America. This land is my land, America. I know one day after I'm gone, someone will carry this dream along. What makes this country so strong? I am America. Grandpa volunteered for the war across the ocean. There's no price for his country he wouldn't pay. Like so many others, he fought for the cause with great devotion. And just like his daddy, he led the way. Yeah, yeah, yeah. His stories have faded with his years, but his eyes say it loud and clear. Down the things he was taught, like loving your neighbor and trusting in God. I am America. This land, my land, America. I know one day, long after I'm gone, someone will carry this dream along, and that's what makes